generation, you may have 350 great rabbis. So he says, in terms of determining whether the second body is greater in numbers, we would also include, as it were, non-members of the Sanhedrin in the vote. But be it as it may, for there you need somebody greater in wisdom and understanding. Now, so we've had these two extremes. Category one, Halacha Moshe Misinai, there's nothing a later basin could do. Category three, a later basin could act only if it was greater in wisdom and numbers. But what about category number two? Category number two is when a Sanhedrin interprets the Torah based on the idea of a drasha. Drasha means interpretation. So here the Rambam says a very surprising thing. The Rambam says, when it comes to interpretations based on drasha, a later basin has the right to interpret the pasuk differently, even if the later Beis Din is lesser in wisdom than the earlier Beis Din. You do not need a greater Beis Din when it comes to the element of drasha. And the reason is because a drasha is based on interpretation of the primary text, which is the Torah. And if a later Beis Din feels that the primary text was incorrectly interpreted, they are obligated to follow their understanding. Now again, I'm not referring to what we could do today. We obviously don't have that power. I'm talking about Sanhedrins. There were Sanhedrins. Okay, so you see this chiluk there. So we divide, in other words, the oral law into these three components. That which is halachal Moshe Misinai cannot be touched. That which is pure rabbinic legislation can be repealed only by a Beis Din that is greater in wisdom and in numbers. But that which is derived by drasha, ironically, can be destroyed or repealed even by a Beis Din that is lesser. That is lesser. So here is the ingenious interpretation that the Brisker Rav says. We've been assuming all along, and this is the halakha, that female Moabite women who convert to Judaism are permitted to enter the Jewish people, and the Torah's prohibition against the male Moabite, against the Moabite, is only limited to the male and not to the female. The question is, how do we know that? So what emerges from the Gemara is there are two separate sources for how we know that. One is a drasha, one is interpretation. Drasha. What's the interpretation? Your interpretation is the following. The Torah says, Lo yavo Moabi b'kal Hashem, a Moabite cannot enter the congregation of God. And the Torah gives the reason. Al devar, because asher loikidmu eschem, they did not come forward olechem uvamayim to offer you bread and water. So the drasha goes like this. Since the Moabites are condemned because they did not come forward to offer us bread and water, that could only apply to men that could be expected to go forward to other men and offer them food. It cannot be expected of women who are normally more tznius. That would be the logical drasha to permit it. However, the Gemara also indicates that it's not just the drasha, but it is a halacha lamosha misinai as well.
Which indicates that?
What indicates what? The Gemara. The Gemara says that. So here is the problem. The Brisker Rav says that when the Goel made a mistake, and the Goel made a mistake about female Moabites, the Brisker Rav says the mistake was not as we thought. He thinks female Moabites are prohibited. If he thinks female Moabites are prohibited, he should have been worried about his sin and not his kids. Rather, the Brisker Rav says he knows female Moabites are permitted. He knows that halacha. But he thinks it's only because of a drasha, an interpretation of a verse. So this is what he's afraid of. I can go ahead and marry her because the Beis Din of my generation interprets the verse this way and therefore it's okay. But what's going to happen if 200 years later some other Beis Din comes to a different interpretation of that verse? And based on the ruling that we discussed from the Rambam, when it comes to laws which are derived from drashos, even a lesser Beis Din could change it. So I'm going to be okay because I followed, you know, my rabbi of my generation. But retroactively, if a later Beis Din concludes that it's prohibited, my children will have the stigma of mamzer. Why is that a mistake, though? The mistake is because the ultimate reason why Moabite women are permitted is not because it's a drasha, but because it's a halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai, and consequently that is immune from attack by a later Beis Din. So according to the Brisker Rav, a very ingenious thought, the mistake that Pliny Almoni is making is not that he thinks that which is permitted is really prohibited. He knows that which is permitted is permitted. But the mistake that he makes is he is not aware of the origin of the prohibition. And because he is not aware of the origin of the prohibition, he is afraid that his children, 100 years hence, henceforth, are subject to a certain risk. Okay? Which they would not be had he been properly aware of the origin. This is the Brisker Rav's pshat. Again, it seems to me that this is making Pliny Almoni a fairly sophisticated Torah scholar, which seems to be against the view in Chazal that he was an ignoramus. I mean, to say that someone knows all this but didn't know, you know, one little aspect of it is making him a fairly good Talmud Chacham. Yeah.
Couldn't it be that in those days?
Yeah.
I mean, they're all on such a high level. Even Pliny Almoni, in comparison, he was.
In other words, he didn't know. It's for his level. He should have known. He should have known everything. Yeah.
Is it true that after Boaz married Ruth,
yes, that's absolutely true. We'll discuss that. Basically, he died the next morning. He consummated his marriage with Ruth, and he died the next morning. And that is not recorded in the Book of Ruth. That is an oral tradition that the rabbis had, and it was not recorded for very good reason, because if part of the purpose of Ruth, the story of Ruth, is to legitimate Ruth as the ancestor of the Davidic line, by saying that she married this great guy Boaz, to record that Boaz died the night after he married her would have destroyed the whole purpose of the story. But in reality, the reason Boaz died, in retrospect, is obviously not because this is a sinful union. This is not a sinful union. It seems to be the opposite. Boaz was kept alive longer than he should have been. Boaz was already an old man, and he was kept as longer than he should in order to consummate this marriage and produce the Davidic life.
Do you know he was younger than his uncle?
Now, what proof do you have that he was younger than his uncle?
Well, I don't have proof, but I'm assuming that the other guy was his uncle.
Well, then that's normally the case, but that doesn't have to be the case. I think the uncle was pretty old and Boaz was pretty old, but it could be that Boaz's father was the oldest of the three brothers. And my wife has a niece that is the same age as her, so these things can happen depending on brother and sister, etc. But Boaz was old, and as I mentioned, according to the Medrash, Boaz had 60 sons and 60 daughters, and all of them had died by this time. He was a widower, and they were all dead. So this was his last fling and his last chance. And the last day of his life, he planted the seed in a very, very literal way of Mashiach, the ultimate redeemer of the world. Yeah.
Regarding the wisdom of the different Sanhedrin, how is it possible that someone at a later time decreed that they're wiser? I mean, how would that even be possible? Who would be valid to say that we're wiser than the previous generation?
Well, you know, you're right. Obviously, one has to be honest and one has to be aware of their limitations. But certainly, a very, very great person might be able to objectively assess whether they're greater or not. You know, it depends. I mean, obviously, for someone to say today, you know, I'm greater than the Beis Din 1,000 years ago, you know, that wouldn't work. But you know, one could imagine a Beis Din makes a decision today somewhere. Then you have a new Sanhedrin. I mean, they might say, well, you know, we're better than that. You know, that one, if one has Yiras Shemayim and one has objectivity, one, you know, might be able to make those types of decisions. Okay. But anyway, this is an important concept in the Rambam anyway about these three types of oral law and the power of a later Beis Din to deal with it. So be it as it may, the Goel turns it down, and what is done here is, again, something that's often confused. We are told that when the Goel wants to renounce his rights. So the Goel has two rights here. The Redeemer has the right to redeem a field, tendering payment and getting a field, and the redeemer has the right to marry Rus. Now this is a package deal. The redeemer does not want to do the second thing, so he doesn't want to do the first thing. So the concept is, when you have rights, and you want to give up your rights, and you want to give up your rights to a third person, the way you give it up is by an act of kinyan. Kinyan is an act of acquisition. Just like if I want to sell you my car, my house, we have to do an act of acquisition. So too, when I want to give you my rights, and intangible rights, we have to do an act of acquisition. And the common way that rights are transferred, even today, rights, I have a right, I want to transfer a right to you, is by symbolic barter. Now, by symbolic barter means, if you have something you want to transfer to me, I give you a handkerchief, I give you a pen, I give you anything, it could be worth a penny. And that's a symbolic barter. By my giving you something, the rights that you have are transferred to me. Okay? The most common article that is used today is a handkerchief. And I'll give you examples of where we do this. When a chassan gets married, when a person gets married, and he obligates himself to his wife to support her and to pay the kesuvah in the event they get divorced, you may notice that the witnesses give him a handkerchief. And the witnesses tell him, lift up this handkerchief. And by you lifting up this handkerchief, that's barter. You've gotten something. By your getting something, that obligates you to do what you want to do. Okay? People sometimes get mixed up because they don't know who's supposed to lift up what. But the way it works is, the guy that is obligating himself receives the handkerchief. Okay? Or when you go to a rabbi and you want to sell your chametz on Pesach, so you're making the rabbi a shaliach. You're giving the rabbi the right to sell chametz. So the rabbi gets that right by giving you a handkerchief, saying, you know, I would give you a handkerchief or a pen, and I would say, lift this up, and by your receipt of the pen, you are transferring to me the right to sell your chametz. Okay? So rights are transferred by symbolic barter. And the term of symbolic barter is called chalipin. Chalipin just means exchange. And it could be worth anything, as long as it's worth a penny, you know, pruta, that's fine. So here is the same thing. The goel, in fact, this is the source of the whole idea of chalipin. The goel is transferring his rights to Boaz. Consequently, what must be done to transfer the right? Boaz must give the goel something, an article, and by that symbolic barter, the goel transfers to Boaz his rights. Now, the article that was commonly employed, the pasuk says, for this symbolic barter in the time of Boaz was not a handkerchief, and it was not a pen, it was a shoe. So according to the halakha, now the verse is extremely ambiguous, because the verse says, and he took off his shoe, and he gave it to him. Now who is the he? You might have said, the goel took off his shoe and he gave it to Boaz. Or you might say, Boaz took off his shoe and he gave it to the goel. The pasuk is totally ambiguous. In fact, it is a machlokas in the Gemara what this process is. But the halacha, I'm interpreting according to the halacha, the final halacha would be that the guy that is acquiring the right is the one who gives his shoe to the other guy. In other words, Boaz, excuse me, would give his shoe to the guy. That's symbolic barter. By the guy getting the shoe, he's transferring the rights. Okay, so that's how we interpret it. Now the only question becomes, why shoe? Because according to halacha, it doesn't have to be a shoe. It could be a pen, could be a handkerchief, could be a ring. It does have to be an object. Money itself is not, money itself does not affect this type of barter. But objects do. Right, so why a shoe? So this was a minhag, this was not a halacha, but the minhag of the shoe is that wearing shoes was the sign of a free man. In fact, we find in the time of Gemara, this was true in Greek and Roman cultures later, that going barefoot was a sign of slavery. In other words, your movements are circumscribed, you can't go where you want to go. Shoes was the sign of a free person, one who could go where he wanted to go. So consequently, when I have a right to do something, and I'm giving up my right to you, I'm giving up some of my freedom. The barter is that the guy that's getting that right, as it were, gives me the shoe, meaning to say, you're giving up your freedom, I'm giving up my freedom symbolically. It's kind of a mutual thing. By the way, it's very instructive. Chazal teach us that when the brothers threw Yosef into the pit and then sold him into slavery, they used the money to buy a pair of shoes. The concept is, now we're free. We don't have this kid who's bothering us anymore. Now we can go where we want to go and do what we want to do. Right? So that's shoes. In fact, even Yom Kippur, taking off your shoes on Yom Kippur is a sign of submission to God, because you don't have this unlimited freedom. Of course, it's funny today, you know, the idea of taking off shoes would be, you know, to be barefoot. Now people have sneakers and Adidas and Reeboks and everything else. You can move around a lot faster, a lot better than you can with shoes, so it's hard to know. The meaning of taking off shoes is much more attenuated today than it could be. The same thing, in other words, service in the temple was barefoot, because that's submission to God, that's becoming a slave to God. Okay, so the shoe is not the halachic aspect of this, but the shoe was the custom, because if you're giving me something, I become your slave in gratitude. I give you my shoe, which is then given back right away. Now, I want to say that a lot of people make a mistake here, and they identify this with chalitza, which in a sense would make sense, because when a man does not want to fulfill the mitzvah of yibum, there is a ceremony of chalitza. But the chalitza, which involves taking off a shoe, doesn't really fit what happens here. Because chalitza would mean that Rus would take off Ploni Almoni's shoe. That's what it would be. And it wouldn't be Boaz taking off his shoe and giving it to Ploni Almoni. You see, that wouldn't work. Moreover, when you have two people who are capable of doing yibum, and one guy says no and the other guy says yes, the guy that says no doesn't have to do chalitza. You only do chalitza when nobody's going to do yibum. When you have multiple candidates, if you have three brothers or two brothers, and one brother says, I don't want to do yibum, and the other brother says he does, you don't need chalitza in that case. Right? So for those two reasons, although I suspect that the use of the shoe metaphor is at least designed to remind us of chalitza. That's probably so, because it's so close to chalitza that it's probably intended to be a remez. But in terms of this actual ceremony, this was not a chalitza ceremony. This was simply the halachic way that the goel transfers his rights, his redemption rights, to Boaz. Okay? And the prophet Shmuel, who wrote this book, testifies that that is still the current practice in his day, that the way one person transfers rights to another person is by the recipient giving his shoe to the one that is selling. Okay. And
where does he do that?
Where does who do what? Does
where
what?
Does the prophet Shmuel.
Well, this is written by the prophet Shmuel. This is the pasuk in pasuk Zion, that this was the custom in Israel for redemptions and for sales. In order to validate everything, one person would take off his shoe and give it to his friends, and this was the accepted practice in Israel. In other words,
right, but it's referring to the time of Boaz.
Well. Again, the pasuk can either mean it was and it's no longer, or the other way around. Shmuel is trying to show that this was such an ancient practice that it was practiced hundreds of years before his time. I mean, you can learn it two ways. Does he mean to point out this is an obsolete practice that was no longer followed, or does he mean to point out that what is done is of ancient vintage?
In other words, it was then as it is now.
Right. Right, that this was the ancient practice of Israel. Okay, so verse 9 now says Boaz now has what he wants. Boaz has legally acquired the right of Ploni Almoni to redeem the fields and to perform the quasi mitzvah of Yibam, and this is done publicly in front of a minion, in front of people sitting at the gate of the city. And Vayomer Boaz laskenim v'chol ha'am, and Boaz says to the elders and all of the people that are there, Eidem atem hayom, you are all my witnesses. Ki konisi es kol asher li Elimelech, I have purchased all of the rights of Elimelech, I purchased his field. The es kol asher v'chilin u'machlon, and the property that belongs to chilin u'machlon, miyad na'ami. And I have also acquired, as it were, Rus, the Moabite, the wife of Machlon, to perpetuate the name of her dead husband on his inheritance, that his name shall not be cut off from his people. Eidem atem hayom, behold, you are witnesses. Now Boaz really has a double issue here. Number one, Boaz wants to be absolutely sure that Ploni Almoni is not going to come in later and start complaining. So he's making a whole point. I bought it. We had a proper kinyan. This was done publicly. And therefore Ploni Almoni just will not have any right later to come and contest this. And second of all, since this is a Moabite woman and there were questions raised about her lineage, Boaz wants, as it were, public affirmation that this is a proper thing. And that was the answer. Vayomru kala'am asher b'shar v'askenim, and all the people that are in the gates and the elders declared, Eidem, we indeed are witnesses to what is going on today. Yitein Hashem esoisha bo'al beisecha, may God bless the woman that you are bringing into your house, like Rachel and Leah, that both have built the house of Israel, Rachel and Leah. Mentions Rachel first. Rachel was Yaakov's more beloved wife. Oh, okay, I'm sorry, we're a little late. Okay, and we'll finish it tomorrow. But basically, they validate the marriage and they give a blessing to the union, and then the pasuk will go on and have the actual marriage done. Okay, so we'll talk about some more tomorrow. begins on page 1272 in the Art Scroll of Chumash. If you remember, Boaz has been shocked or surprised into the recognition that there would be a mitzvah to perpetuate the soul of Mahlon, Ruth's husband. But there is a closer relative that has the right of priority. This closer relative's name is Tov, but he's also referred to by the name Ploni Almoni, which is either anonymous or Chazal say it is a remes to his ignorance in Torah. Pele means Ploni is the Torah is covered from him, and Almoni is he's an Elaim, he is mute, he is unable to articulate the Torah. Now if you remember the way it worked, is that Boaz turns to the Goel, the Redeemer, and says, look in verse 3, chapter 4, verse 3, on page 1272, right, so this is in front of 10 people. Vayaymer la Goel, and Boaz says to the Redeemer, Chelka sasaga asher lo achinu l'elimelech, the portion of the field that belonged to our brother Elimelech. Now remember, the way Chazal understand the Yichus, Elimelech is not really Boaz's brother. Elimelech and Tov and Salmon, that is Boaz's father, are brothers. But nevertheless, a nephew in Biblical Hebrew can refer to an uncle as a brother, because since a son takes the place of his father, so in effect, Boaz takes the place of his father, who was a brother of Elimelech. So the field that belonged to our brother Elimelech, Machra Naomi, so literally this says, Naomi has sold this field, Hashava Mistei Moav, she who has returned from Moav, Vani Amarti, and Boaz says, and I have said the following, Egla Osnecha Lemor, I want to reveal your ear, meaning I want to tickle your ear with this proposition that you might find attractive. Kinei, buy this field, meaning exercise the mitzvah of redemption, right? There is a mitzvah in the Torah that a relative should redeem the field of a poor person who sold their field. Kinei neged hayeshvim, buy the field next to those who are sitting down, like do it publicly, v'neged zikneyemi, and against the elders. Im tigal, if you want to redeem, gaal, go ahead and do it. V'imlo yigal, but if you do not wish to redeem, hagidoli, tell me this now, v'eida, that I may know it. Ki ein zulascha ligol, there is no one else besides you to redeem, except for me, v'anochi, and I am acharecha. So what you have here is a proposition that the field of Naomi, now literally it says has been sold, but if you remember the way Rashi interprets it, machra does not mean Naomi has sold it, but it means Naomi is planning on selling it because of her poverty. And the idea is the same way that there's a mitzvah in the Torah for a relative to redeem a field that has already been sold to keep it in the family. So Rashi says, kal v'chomer, to prevent a sale, or in other words, if my relative is going to sell the field to somebody else, there's a mitzvah on me to be the one who buys it. Right? So that's the geula that we're talking about. So when it comes to the field, vayomer, the goel says, anochi egal. Sure, I'd love to do that. So now, vayomer Boaz, so now Boaz says, oh yes, there's a little string attached that I forgot to tell you about. And that is, biyom kenoscha hasadeh miyad Naomi, the day that you buy the field, actually this is a proof to Rashi's pshat, by the way, because if we take the earlier verse literally, that Naomi had already sold the field, then how could verse 5 say the day that you buy the field from Naomi? The Goel would not be buying the field from Naomi. The Goel would be buying the field to the person that Naomi had sold the field. So this itself is linguistic evidence to Rashi's explanation that machra does not mean she already sold it, but machra means she is planning on selling it. And consequently, whoever would buy the field would be buying the field from Naomi herself. So Boaz says, the day that you buy the field from Naomi, umei eis rus hamoaviyah eishes hameis kanisa, you will also be buying something from Rus, meaning you'll be buying her, lahakim shame hames, to perpetuate, to establish the name of the dead, mainly Machlein, Rus's husband, al nachalasa. In other words, Rashi explains that this linkage was done by Naomi, although Boaz is the one that's articulating it. Boaz says that Naomi will agree to sell her fields only to the one that agrees to marry Rus. And if you don't agree to marry Rus, you don't have the right to redeem the field. I will sell the field, or Naomi will sell the field to someone else. So on this, the Goel responds, Vayomer HaGoel, the Redeemer says, that string attached I cannot accept. Lo uchal ligoli. I am unable to redeem this field. Pen ashchis es nachalasi, lest I destroy my inheritance. I'll explain that. And therefore, ga'al lecha ata es geulasi. So he turns to Boaz and says, you go ahead and redeem that which I should have redeemed. Geulasi means that which I should have redeemed. Ki lo yuchal ligol. He repeats it. I'm not going to do it. I can't do it. So Rashi explains the issue is the following. The term, I cannot do it because I would destroy my inheritance. What inheritance would he destroy? So Rashi says the word nachalasi does not refer to land. I mean, he wouldn't be destroying his land by buying this land. If anything, he would be increasing his holdings. But nachalasi refers to your children, because your children, your descendants, your offspring, are the ultimate legacy and inheritance that you leave in the world. So he says, I can't marry Rus, because if I marry Rus, I'm going to ruin the status of all my future offspring that I get from Rus. What is he afraid of? So Rashi says that the Goyel, as was common, is under the misperception that the Torah's prohibition that an Ammonite and a Moabite cannot enter the congregation of God, even if they convert, because of their selfishness, their lack of generosity in giving us food and water, does not only apply, the halakha says it only applies to the male and not the female. But the Goel assumed that it applies equally to male and female. Therefore, the Goel says, if I marry Rus, I will be committing the Avera of marrying a Moabite, and the consequence of my committing that Avera is that the children that are born from that union, they're not going to be mamzer. In order to be a mamzer, it has to be adultery or incest. But they will be tainted with the status. In other words, the halacha basically is that if you marry a woman or a person who's not allowed to enter into the Jewish people, the children that you have are imprinted with the same stigma. So he means, I can't marry this woman because that would therefore mean that my children, my descendants, will be stigmatized and imprinted with the disability of marrying within the Jewish people.
Or it would happen to me what happened to Manon.
What happened to Machlo? Well, that's right. Perhaps the Goel is even thinking that Machlo, of course that depends if Rus had converted then or not, but he might be thinking that maybe that's related to Machlon dying. That's a very good, precisely for that reason. So what's interesting is, therefore, that and that's why he's called Ploni Almoni, he was ignorant of Torah, because his refusal to marry Rus was predicated on his ignorance of the halacha, that in fact it was permitted for him to marry Rus. Now what's interesting is, Boaz does not attempt to re-inform him, in other words, because Boaz wants the opportunity for himself. So Boaz just hears the guy say, I don't want to do it, and Boaz says, fine, I'll do it. And then of course Boaz announces that it's permitted and everything else. So this is an interesting example of, as I mentioned, the Sharei Tshuva brings down, that if one wants to do a mitzvah, and somebody might take it away from him, but you know some reason why that person would want to do it, you're not obligated to inform him of that in order for you not to lose the opportunity to do a particular mitzvah. But here's the question. There's a question that the Mefarshim ask here, and that is the following. If the Goel's mistake is that he thinks it's halachically prohibited to marry Moabite women, if that's his halachic orientation, then he shouldn't have said, I can't do it because it'll impose a stigma on my children. Only, he should have said, I can't do it because it's not allowed. In other words, his concern seems to be, I can't do it because since it's halachically impermissible, it will impose a stigma on the children I have from this union. But forget about that, even if there would be no children from that union. If in his erroneous opinion, it's erroneous, if in his erroneous opinion, you're not allowed to marry a female Moabite, then according to his shita, he should have said, I can't do it because it's usur. Why does he emphasize ped ashchis es nachalasi? So I saw the Maharsha at Maseches Yevamos says a very interesting thing, very, very difficult thing, actually, halachically, it's totally problematical, but I'll share it with you. Let's take the mitzvah of Yibam. Right now, the mitzvah of Yibam sometimes can involve prohibitions. Let's take a very simple example. Let's say a Kohen dies, and without children, and his wife, therefore, needs Yibam from the brother. And let's assume that the brother of the Kohen happens to be a Kohen Gadol. Now, a Kohen Gadol is not allowed to marry a widow. But now there's a mitzvah of Yibam, right? So what do you do in those cases? So there actually is a rule, which is rule of Chol HaTorah Kula, that says that when you have a positive commandment to do something, and the only way you can fulfill the positive commandment to do something, the only way, is by transgressing a negative commandment. The only way you can do thou shalt is by transgressing a thou shalt not. So which commandment has priority? The rule is the positive commandment has priority. The most common example that we find in our daily lives is, let's say, it's the eighth day after birth. Is Shabbos. A baby was born on Shabbos. A boy was born on Shabbos. And therefore the eighth day is Shabbos. Now, doing a bris really involves the transgression of malachos, of bleeding, making a wound, etc. These are one of the 39 malachos of Shabbos. When you cut into somebody and you cause bleeding, you transgress the negative commandment, lo sasa kol malacha, do not do work on Shabbos. So how come you're allowed to do a bris on Shabbos? The answer is, because since there's a positive commandment to do a bris on the eighth day, and the only way I could do the mitzvah on the eighth day is by desecrating the Shabbos, in such a case, the positive commandment overrides the negative. Now, that's not true when, let's say, the bris is delayed, and Shabbos is the ninth day, because there is no mitzvah to circumcise on the ninth day. There's a mitzvah, in other words, once you're past the eighth day, there's a mitzvah to circumcise. So I don't need to violate Shabbos to do the mitzvah, because I could just wait another day. Because doing a bris on the ninth day and doing a bris on the tenth day after birth is the same mitzvah. So we can't say in such a case, the only way I could fulfill the mitzvah of a bris is to do it on Shabbos. That's not true. I can do it on Sunday. But when Shabbos is the eighth day, and there's a special commandment in the Torah that you do a bris on the eighth day, the halacha is the positive overrides the negative. This is called asei doche, a mitzvah asei, a positive commandment pushes aside, it sets aside a negative commandment.
Isn't Shabbos an asei also?
That's a good kasha. Shabbos is both a negative and a positive. That's correct. It says, don't do malacha, and zochar shem Shabbos, etc. Yeah. On the other hand, the positive of Shabbos does not refer to malacha per se, though. The positive of Shabbos refers to, well, there are a few positives. One of the positives of Shabbos, remember the Shabbos, refers to making kiddush and the like. But there is a positive. There is tishbos, you shall rest. Yeah, that's a kasha that the Mefarshim ask in terms of, because although we have a rule that a positive sets aside a negative, it doesn't set aside a negative and a positive. That's a good kasha. The Mefarshim talk about that. I don't have an answer off the top of my head, but the question is discussed.
With cesarea, yeah. We don't do it the day that it's Saturday.
Which one?
Cesarea.
That's correct. Cesarean, you don't do it. That's a xeris akusif, you don't do it. The mila is not done on Shabbos for a cesarean. Only when it's born in the normal way. Another example the Gemara gives of a positive superseding a negative is in the days when they used to have tchelas, of course now some people do have it, tchelas is the blue dye, and the halacha is, we know that tchelas must be wool, the blue must be dyed in the wool. So let's say you have a linen garment. So the only way you could fulfill the mitzvah of tchelas is by putting woolen tzitzis in a linen garment. So the halacha is you are allowed to do so because although wearing shatnas, woolen linen is a negative commandment, the positive commandment of tzitzis overrides the negative commandment of shatnas. Now that doesn't apply if you don't have tchelas, because if I don't have tchelas, my tzitzis could be linen. So if I have a linen garment, I have no reason to have woolen tzitzis, per se. But when you have tchelas, you must have wool, tchelas must be wool, so consequently that's an example of a positive superseding a negative. Now the Ramban gives an interesting, beautiful reason why that's so. The Ramban says, why is a positive more important than a negative? Because he says, negative commandments express the emotion of fear of Hashem. A negative commandment means, don't overstep your boundaries, hold yourself back, be scared of Hashem, and don't violate His will. The positive commandments, like wearing tefillin, making kiddush, and the like, they represent acts of love for Hashem. And since loving God is a greater madrega than fear of God, those mitzvahs that express love of Hashem override those mitzvahs that express fear of Hashem. This is the Ramban's idea, halachically, why asay docha lo sasa. Now, here is what the Marsha says. The Marsha says an amazing thing, really. It's really an amazing thing because halachically it just isn't true. But the Marsha says like this. The Goel is making a mistake, right? The Goel has, actually this is a funny thing, because this turns the Goel into a Talmud Chacham who's making a mistake. It says, the Goel makes the mistake and thinks there's a negative commandment to marry a Moabite woman. That's a mistake. However, even according to his mistake, it's only a negative commandment. On the other hand, since it's Machlon's widow, there's a mitzvah of Yibum. Oh, do you want to talk to me? There's a mitzvah of Yibum. So the Goel is not afraid that he's committing a sin, because even under his erroneous interpretation that there's a negative commandment here because she's a Moabite woman, but the positive commandment of Yibum is going to supersede the negative commandment of Moabite. But what he's afraid of is, that's going to permit me to do it. But if in fact this is a forbidden union, it's still going to taint my children. And that's why the Maharsha says in Yevamos, his concern is only for the kids, his concern is not for himself. What is a pella about that is, even if I say a positive commandment can override a negative, that's only when there's a commandment of Yibum. The commandment of Yibum is only a brother marrying a brother's widow. This is certainly not a commandment of Yibum, because remember, the relationship between Boaz and Machlon is that of first cousins. They're cousins, they're not brothers. So we explained, the Ramban explained, that even though it's not a mandatory Yibum, but it is the concept of a relative perpetuating, but certainly if it's not a mandatory mitzvah cannot set aside a negative commandment, unless the Marsha would say that's part of Ploni Almoni's ignorance. Now, it's kind of a very sophisticated ignorance. Yeah?
Were they first cousins or one?
No. Boaz and Machlon are first cousins, because the way it works was Boaz's father and Elimelech are brothers. So therefore, Machlon and Boaz are direct first cousins. Ploni Almoni was an uncle. The guy. I'm sorry, you're correct. I misspoke. I was thinking of Boaz. We're talking about the Goel. Yeah. The guy that's turning it down is the uncle. Yeah. That's right. Uncle and nephew. Yeah. Boaz is a cousin. Yeah. That's correct. This guy who's turning it down vis-a-vis Machlon, the guy who died, is uncle to nephew. But it's the same issue. Uncle to nephew, there's no mandatory Yibum there at all. So, according to the Marsha, we're going to have to assume, well, that's part of this guy's misinterpretation. So he kind of knows a lot of Jewish law, but at the same time, the knowledge isn't very clear. But it's an interesting idea that even if something is prohibited, it might be set aside by a mitzvah, but it's not going to protect the kids further down the line. You did a mitzvah, but it's still a prohibited union that's going to taint the kids. That itself is debatable. One could argue, right? If the mitzvah supersedes the avera, then there should be no avera stigmatizing the kids either, right? But the Marsha is assuming a composite thing, that the mitzvah supersedes the avera, allowing me to transgress it, but I've still introduced that poison into my lineage. But there's another explanation from the Briska Rav. Again, our question is what? Our question is, if the Goel is making this mistake by thinking he's not allowed to marry a Moabite woman, even though she converted, then why does he only express his hesitations in terms of his children? He ought to say, I can't do it because it's a sin on my part. So here, this is a thought from the Briska Rav. Now, Briska Rav just means the Rav of the city of Brisk. Right? Brisk was a city in Lithuania, or in our Russia, Brest-Litovsk. And, of course, anyone who was the Rav of Brisk could be called the Briska Rav, but we commonly use the name for Rav Yitzchak Ze'ev Soloveitchik. Rav Yitzchak Ze'ev Soloveitchik was the uncle of Rav Yosha Ber Soloveitchik of YU, his university, who died a few years ago, around 4 years ago. And he lived in Yerushalayim. He came to Yerushalayim in the middle of the war from Warsaw, a very miraculous way of being saved. And he was largely regarded as you know, really perhaps the Gadol Hador in Eretz Yisrael. And much of Yerushalayim's religious character, the good and the bad, really, is attributed to the Briska Rav. The Briska Rav was an extremely zealous person, very, 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 very strict, very, very machmir. And that's kind of the, in fact, we even have an expression, Brisker Chumras, you may have heard. Brisker Chumras are the special stringencies that only the Briskers have. And that really comes from Yitzchak Ze'ev Soloveitchik. In fact, it's interesting that the Rosh Yeshiva of Elushna, the Netziv, once said about the difference between him and the Soloveitchiks, because they were co-Rosh Yeshivas for a while. And he described the difference, how they enjoy Pesach, what are their reactions the night after the day after the Seder. So the Netziv, who was a more easygoing person, said to himself, the morning after the Seder, I come to Shul and I'm so filled with joy and happiness and thanksgiving that I was zochet to experience Yetzias Mitzrayim. You know, just such a great mood. And the Soloveitchik come to Shul the next morning and they're so upset. They're wondering, did I eat enough matzah? Did I do enough maror? You know, did I recline the right number of degrees? And he says there's such a preoccupation that you know, he doesn't enjoy the yom tov. Okay, but be it as it may, the Briska Rav says the following explanation. When we look at the concepts of Torah Shebal Peh, the oral interpretation of the Torah, there are many, many different components of Torah Shebal Peh. A certain part of Torah Shebal Peh was directly given by God to Moshe on Mount Sinai. Right? For example, tefillin are black. How do you know tefillin are supposed to be black? How do you know tefillin are supposed to be square? But the Torah doesn't describe it. What are tefillin? Phylacteries, right? Whatever they are. So, these halachos were given by God to Moshe as an oral, supplementary oral tradition. Right? The oral law that is simultaneously passed down from generation to generation along with the Torah. However, we also find that there's another type of Torah Shebal Peh. And that is when the Chachamim look at psukim, they look at verses, and they interpret those verses in light of the 13 principles of interpretation. Now this is a mistake a lot of people make. A lot of people assume that all of that was also given to Moshe B'Sinai. But the Rambam doesn't say that. The Rambam says God gave Moshe the principles of interpretation. But then the Chachamim of each generation have the power to use those principles. I don't mean Chachamim today, but when there's a Sanhedrin, they have the power to use those principles and extract new laws. So, in a sense, you see, the concept is, many of the laws that are extracted by use of the 13 principles of interpretation were not directly given by Moshe B'Sinai. In a sense, they are, because the principles under which these laws are extracted were given by Hashem to Moshe. But the actual laws are canons of interpretation. They are the interpretive techniques. However, since it is based on the principles of interpretation that were given by Hashem, the laws do have the status of Torah laws. In other words, the laws that the Rabbanan extract by virtue of interpretation are d'oraisa laws. They're not rabbinic laws. They are d'oraisa laws, although they were not given to Moshe Mitzrayim. Now, there's a third type of Rabbanan, and that is a pure rabbinic law, which is not based on any type of oral law, and that is rabbinic legislation. Right? The rabbis make many laws which are not based on the Torah at all. For example, when the rabbis make a takana to light Hanukkah candles or read Megillah, right? That's not in the Torah. That's called a takana. That's a positive enactment. Or a more common thing is when the rabbis make a fence around the Torah. What's a fence around the Torah? That the rabbis say, do not do X, which the Torah allows you to do. You're allowed to do it, but the rabbanan say, do not do X, because if we allow you to do X, you may come too close to doing Y, which you're not allowed to do. Right? That's called a gezeira, and that's called making a fence around the Torah. Gezeiros, you know, the examples are too numerous. There are literally thousands of gezeiros. One example is all the laws of muktzah. Right? We say we don't handle on Shabbos money, we don't handle on Shabbos pens. Now, there's nothing wrong with picking up, as far as the Torah is concerned, there's no problem with picking up a pen on Shabbos. I mean, the Torah says you're not allowed to write, but picking up a pen is okay. But the Rabbanan prohibited handling the stuff that you're not allowed to use, because there's a fear that if you pick it up, you know, you might come to write with a pen and the like. Right? That's called a gezeira. Okay, so we have three types of rabbinic activity, so to speak. One type of rabbinic activity is when they simply act as transmitters of laws that were given to Moshe on Sinai. They're not innovating, they're not creating, they're not interpreting. They're simply preserving and transmitting. Okay, they're like a living telephone wire, as it were. The second is when the Rabbanan utilize the principles of biblical interpretation to extract halachos based on the drasha. It's called the drasha of Pesukim. And there, they are creating halacha, really, because the halacha itself was not given to Moshe B'Sinai, but because they were given permission to do so by utilization of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's principles of interpretation, that does have the status of Torah law. It's not Rabbanan, it's the Oraisa. The third is pure rabbinic legislation, when we have takanos, you know, positive enactments, or gezeiros, fences around the Torah. Now, an issue that the Rambam discusses is, if an earlier Sanhedrin offers a certain interpretation of something, does a later Sanhedrin have the right to disagree with that? Now again, we're not talking about today, but when there was a Sanhedrin, could a later Sanhedrin overrule or repeal the decisions of an earlier Sanhedrin? Right. What are the parameters there? So the Rambam says it all depends on what type of activity is being involved. Now, obviously, if Sanhedrin number one is transmitting an oral tradition given by Hashem to Moshe on Sinai, there is obviously no role at all for a later Sanhedrin to disagree with that, because that is something Hashem told Moshe. Right? So if it's category one, there's nothing a later Sanhedrin can do. They're going to be bound by that, because that's halacha l'Moshe Mitzrayim. Now, what about category number three? Category number three is rabbinic legislation. Right? Let's take Ner Hanukkah. Let's assume that Sanhedrin, as they did do, proclaimed they were supposed to light Hanukkah candles. A later Sanhedrin, let's assume after a bunch of fire accidents and burns, decided this is too dangerous a custom for Klal Yisrael. We want to repeal the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles. Or we'll make a counter takana, you only do it one night. Okay? So could a later Sanhedrin repeal a takana of an earlier Sanhedrin? So here the Gemara says the following. Ein beistin yachol levatel divrei beistin chavero. A later Sanhedrin cannot annul the decision of an earlier Sanhedrin. Ela im kein. Unless it is gadol mimenu, it is greater than that earlier Sanhedrin, v'chachma, in wisdom, uva minyan, and in number. But I'll describe the number thing, it's a little problematical. But so essentially the answer is, a later Beis Din could theoretically repeal the decisions of an earlier Beis Din based on Takana or Gezeirah, but only in the rare case that they were greater in wisdom and number, and given the fact, as we generally know, the generations tend to decrease in Torah learning and wisdom, so as a practical matter that doesn't work. Now, one side point, the Rambam raises this question, what do we mean unless it's greater in wisdom and numbers? I understand what it means to be greater in wisdom, that's to be greater in wisdom, but how could it be greater in numbers? Every Sanhedrin is only 71 people, the great Sanhedrin. So how could a later Sanhedrin be greater in numbers than earlier? You've created an impossible condition. Greater in wisdom is at least theoretically possible. Greater in numbers is not possible at all. So the Rambam explains that for purposes of this halacha, we don't only count the members of the Sanhedrin